This is the Weber Teleclass Series, and on behalf of Dr. Saeed Sattar and Paul Weber, I wish to greet all of our audience who are attending today. My name is Lynn Seeholster. I am a health scientist at CDC's Healthcare Quality Promotion Division in Atlanta, Georgia, and I am guest hosting for today. Our speaker today is a good friend and colleague of mine, and it's my honor and privilege to introduce him to you. Dr. Lennox Archibald is a healthcare hospital epidemiologist currently at the College of Medicine, the University of Florida, and is also serving as medical director for RTI Biologics. Now, he is a colleague of mine because a number of years ago, not that many, but he was a class member of the Epidemic Intelligence Service officers at CDC and came on full-time in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion for a number of years, where one of the things was his passion was healthcare epidemiology in other countries around the world, where he is conducted investigations in Vietnam, in countries in Africa, and throughout the United States. He certainly has a track record in academia. He is has an undergraduate degree from Harvard University here in the U.S. His medical degree is from the University College in London, and his postgraduate training in internal and tropical medicine is was achieved at London, Oxford, and Liverpool. He also completed infectious diseases and microbiology fellowships at Duke University here in the States, and he also received his higher doctoral degree from the University of London. And he is honored as a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians in London. So we have a world-renowned speaker ahead of us here, and he will present to you today a lecture on ventilator-associated pneumonia in the United States, epidemiology, diagnosis, and prevention. So, Dr. Archibald, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lynn, and greetings to everyone. My name is Dr. Archibald, and for the next 55 minutes, I'm going to address the issue of ventilator-associated pneumonia. I mentioned in the United States, but I think it's going to be applicable to patients anywhere in the world where mechanical ventilation is instituted. And the first slide, you know, basically summarizes what Carlene Muto said about 5-6 years ago, and that is, for as long as CDC has measured the prevalence of hospital-acquired infections in the United States, those infections caused by multi-drug-resistant organisms, they have never documented a downward trend. It has always been increasing, and that is resistant infections caused by resistant Staph aureus and also resistant gram-negatives. And in the second slide, and you know, that first slide goes along with the fact that over the past decade, CDC has actually documented a downward trend in infection rates in the four major anatomic sites, the respiratory tract, of course, bloodstream, urinary tract, and womb. But at the same time, infection rates due to resistant pathogens are increasing. So if you put the data from the first and second slides together, it basically what it says is that nosocomial infections due to resistant pathogens are on the increase. And the third slide is work I actually did at CDC, where I looked at the data from the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System. And what it suggests is that since the 1980s, in the United States, while the number of general medical beds have been decreasing, the number of ICU beds have been increasing. And what heretofore used to be done in the inpatient service is now being done in the outpatients, freestanding medical or surgical care centers across the United States or the home. So basically what's happening in the United States is hospitals are becoming critical care units. And what happens in critical care units? Of course, patients are very ill. They are likely to be mechanically ventilated. They're going to have intravascular lines, central venous lines, as well as arterial lines. They're more likely to have urinary catheter, chest tubes, rectal tubes, and surgical wounds. So the patients are, well, within that context, mechanical ventilation appears to be an important issue that I do not see the issue decreasing in the foreseeable future. Hence, what I've done here is underscored the clinical and public health implications for critical care units here in the United States and elsewhere. So, going on to the issue of hospital-acquired pneumonia, which is, you know, of ventilator-associated pneumonia is just one form of hospital-acquired pneumonia. What we do know is that 31%, so that is almost 31% of all healthcare-associated infections in the United States are basically hospital-acquired pneumonia. 27% of all hospital infections in MICUs, that is medical intensive care units, are basically pneumonia, hospital-acquired. And 28%, that is a little over a quarter of all hospital-acquired infections in trauma patients, are hospital-associated pneumonia. So and what this underscores, again, is the reality, the epidemiology, that it's not a minor problem. It's a significant, substantial problem. The next slide actually summarizes work by Mike Richards. Mike Richards was a colleague of mine from Australia who spent a couple of years doing a fellowship in the hospital infections program at CDC. And what he looked at a lot of the NIST data. And what the next slide underscores is that for hospital-associated pneumonia in the United States, 83% of those are mechanically ventilated. The next slide, again, taking the data from that Mike Richards looked at, hospital-associated pneumonia, the incident rate is basically, it goes anywhere between 4.2 to 7.7 infections per 1,000 discharges. And, very important, it's the leading cause of intensive care unit antimicrobial prescribing, and I will be saying a little bit more about that later on. And as one would expect, the next slide shows morbidity is high. Fatality rates are high. And the attributable mortality rate runs, if you look at the published literature, is anywhere between 20 to 33%. So, you know, this is very, very high within the scope of things. And ventilator-associated pneumonia. So I use the term, VAP, VAP, so for the remainder of the presentation, I will be calling ventilator-associated pneumonia, I will be referring to it as a VAP. So VAP accounts for 60% of all deaths due to hospital-associated infections. And in studies in which invasive techniques were used to diagnose VAP, crude mortality rates range widely, you know, went from 4% in patients with VAP but without, who had not received antecedent antimicrobial therapy, to 73% in some cohorts in patients caused by with VAP caused by Pseudomonas or Acinetobacter. Now, what about costs? Now, you know, that's, you know, it's, cost is an issue that's relevant for developed countries like the United States or for hospitals in less developed countries in Africa, the Caribbean, where I come from, or Southeast Asia. Well, VAPs can prolong ICU stay by an average of at least 4 to 6 days and hospitalization for up to 9 days. And the estimate, and these are estimates done by some very clever people and who looked at it in detail, the estimated cost, direct cost of excess hospital stay due to a VAP in the United States is at least $40,000 per patient. And that is a lot of money. Now, the next slide shows a pie chart. This is from a book chapter I wrote a couple of years ago. And basically, it summarizes the data from the NIST hospitals. And I forgot to mention, the NIST hospital is the acronym for the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System. That's the surveillance system which has since been renamed to the NHSN, that's National Health and Safety Network. Well, the NIST data looked at collect aggregated data from hospitals across the United States for various types of nosocomial infections. So this is a reflection. This pie chart is a reflection of the status of ICUs in hospitals with greater than 100 beds in the United States. And as you can see on the chart, Staph aureus is the number one cause of VAP in the United States. Number two is Pseudomonas, three Enterobacter, four Klebsiella, and five is Acinetobacter. So number one was the Staph aureus. So 2, 3, 4, 5 are gram-negative rods, and which brings us to the issue of gram-negative pathogens. And if you look at the CDC data from 1986 through 2003, 65% of pneumonia episodes were caused by gram-negative pathogens. And worrying, and the other bullet on that slide for gram-negative pathogens is actually worrying, where the it indicates that the proportion of Acinetobacter pneumonias has actually increased from 4% in 1986 to over 7% in 2003, and I know that it's even higher now. So basically, it's basically been doubled over the last two decades. That's for Acinetobacter. So, which brings us, one would naturally ask, why are gram-negative pneumonias increasing in hospitals in the United States? And I know if you look at the published literature, they are increasing in Western Europe and also in ICUs in hospitals in less developed countries. Why are gram-negative pneumonias increasing? Well, I'm going to touch on it just briefly, but I think it's important. What happens is gram-negative pathogens adhere to the host tissue via these antimicrobial adhesions, and they interact with receptors on mucosal surfaces via these adhesing receptor interactions. And these adhesin receptors define bacterial populations. Now, we know that gram-negatives, Pseudomonas, Enterobacter, they all have these, they interact with respiratory epithelium via these interactions. What we know is that there are changes in these adhesins associated with resistant microorganisms. And that is that brings up the issue of tissue trophism, which is a tendency for a particular bug to go to attach to a specific type of tissue. So gram-negatives tend to go for respiratory tissues. Some viruses, like the hepatitis virus, have a tendency for the liver. So here is the thing. When you have, if you have a gram-negative microorganism and it becomes resistant, what we know is that the resistant strains of Pseudomonas, for instance, is more likely to stick to the respiratory epithelium, where these interactions become more permanent than a non-resistant strain. Hence, the role of antimicrobial use. There you see the linkage between controlling antimicrobial use. So control of the VAP must include control of antimicrobial use in ICUs. So control of antimicrobials hopefully reduces the likelihood that a strain would become resistant, and that would likely reduce the tendency for a resistant strain to permanently attach to the respiratory tract. And this is a simplistic, short summary of the molecular relevance of resistance. Other emerging gram-negative pathogens include Stenotrophomonas and beta-lactamase-producing pathogens like Enterobacter cloacae, Klebsiella pneumonia, and carbapenemase-producing Klebsiella pneumonia. And again, their tendency for the respiratory tract is enhanced when the strains become resistant. And again, what do you do? Well, you try to reduce antimicrobial use. So the other question is, where do the bugs come from? Well, this, you know, one can spend hours talking about this, because the microorganisms come from patients or other patients or healthcare workers. It might come from the patient's oral cavity, stomach, intestines, the air, the water supply, medical equipment, work surfaces, white coats, watch straps, stethoscopes, ties, and even false fingernails. And, you know, microorganisms like Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter love false fingernails, the material that's used. And then we go on to, what are the intrinsic factors in patients that that encourage, are conducive to gram-negative bugs causing respiratory tract infections? Well, the obvious intrinsic factors. Age. Somebody age greater than 70, you're more likely, you're more at risk. Malnutrition, alcohol, and these, tobacco, severe chronic lung and heart disease, diabetes, connective tissue disorders. These problems are all outlined in standard medical textbooks. And we know there's a ton of data published about the role of these intrinsic risk factors that make patients susceptible. But then, what about specific risk factors for VAPS? Well, there's unequivocal data that mechanical assisted ventilation is the prime risk factor. And then immunosuppression from various causes, whether it's malignancy, blood dyscrasias, conditions like diabetes, alcohol dependence. And then depressed sensorium. So if someone is comatose, then they're more at risk for a VAP. And there's a ton of literature out there that shows that thoracic abdominal surgery is a risk factor. In fact, the scenic data, that's data from the 1960s from CDC, actually implicated thoracoabdominal surgery as a risk factor for VAP. So we have known that data for a long time. Other major risk factors include critically ill patients, primary admitting diagnosis of burns, trauma, or central nervous system disease. And I just mentioned thoracoabdominal surgery, and we have known that since the 60s and 70s, depressed level of consciousness from any cause, and a prior episode of a large volume aspiration, which is basically a pneumonitis. But someone with a pneumonitis caused by aspiration is more likely to acquire a VAP once the mechanical ventilation has been initiated. Other major risk factors include, and these are all borne out by epidemiologic studies, 24-hour ventilator circuit changes, being an inpatient in the fall or winter season, severe trauma, or someone in a recumbent position. So someone lying flat is more likely to acquire it. There's epidemiologic data that define these risk factors. And endotracheal or nasal intubation is an independent risk factor. Extracorporeal renal support is an independent risk factor for a VAP. Use of a nasogastric tube, tracheostomy, or bronchoscopy are each independent risk factors. And later on in the talk, you will get an understanding of why these risk factors, the pathogenesis, how they lead to the pathogenesis of the pneumonia. How about risk factors related to therapy? Well, that's a sort of obvious thing. So I just mentioned recent antimicrobial therapy is an independent risk factor. Immunosuppressive therapy, steroids, chemotherapy, stress bleeding prophylaxis with cimetidine, with or without an antacid. And what that does, it results in an increase in the pH of the GI tract of the stomach. An increase in pH makes the stomach more alkaline and less acidic. So that enhances the proliferation of the microorganisms in the stomach that could lead to pneumonias or that are conducive to the development of a pneumonia. Parenteral nutrition is an independent risk factor. So let's look at we have now defined and in bullet form the risk factors, and as I said before, there are a ton of data there for each of these where you can go and do a literature search and look at these risk factors. So these are borne out, but let's see how they play a role in the development. The main risk factors: endotracheal intubation, mechanical ventilation, microaspiration of oropharyngeal secretions, and upper airway colonization in severely ill patients. Let's look at these individually. Endotracheal intubation. Well, let's see, how does endotracheal intubation lead to a VAP? Well, what it does, just having an endotracheal tube in and of itself, it impairs the host defense mechanism because it's going down into the upper respiratory tract. The cough reflex is affected, so mucociliary clearance, which is a really important cause, an important method by which the body clears untoward stuff from the upper respiratory tract. That's affected. So that facilitates VAP just from a mechanical perspective. And especially when it's long-term, one can get ulceration of the upper respiratory of the trachea. And again, the patient in that instance would lose the cough reflex. The second is, how about mechanical ventilation? Well, the issue of mechanical ventilation in the pathogenesis is, the first thing is the duration of the ventilation is the key problem. And ventilation for over 24 hours is key. And here is the interesting thing with mechanical ventilation. There's a cumulative increased risk of VAP with time. And again, these statements are all borne out by published studies. We know that there's a decreasing daily risk. So during the first week, there is a risk of 3% per day in the first week. So at the end of the first week, the risk is about 21% of getting a VAP. But then that risk decreases. It's 2% per day by the second week and 1% per day by the third week. So 21 and then 14. So one could see that at the end of 3 weeks, the risk of getting a VAP is over 30%. But again, if you look at each week individually, the highest risk is during the first 8 to 10 days of mechanical ventilation, where the risk is up to 21%. And that's important. So if a VAP is likely to happen, the probability is it's going to happen in the first week. And the other thing we know about mechanical ventilation is that when it's compared with non-invasive mechanical ventilation, which is indicated by the acronym NIV, lower rates are much more common. You get lower rates with non-invasive mechanical ventilation. So let's go on to the third item in terms of pathogenesis, microaspiration of oropharyngeal secretions. Well, that's a very common event, because if you think about it, the upper airway is colonized with a lot of bugs that might come from the oropharynx. And some of those pathogens are potentially pathogenic in the severely ill. They might not be in somebody who is well and healthy. And altered mental status sets the stage for this. And so someone who is confused or comatose is more likely to have microaspiration of oropharyngeal secretion. So, you know, that brings up, is it avoidable? And that is something that is often debated. And the general consensus is yes, but then it is avoidable. But then how you make it avoidable, that's the difficulty. And I will address that later on. What we know is that raising the head of the bed at least 10 degrees results in reduced rates of VAPs. Regular checks of the feeding tube. And, you know, these are all related to microaspiration of oropharyngeal secretions. Routine assessment of intestinal motility and adjusting feed volumes accordingly. And some people have tried, some researchers have tried using small bore feeding tubes. But there is no consistent evidence that is using small bore tubes actually reduces the tendency for microaspiration. So of all of these, on this slide for microaspiration, I think the data suggests that raising the head of the bed at least 10 degrees has been found to be the most consistently effective. And I'll say a lot more about this later on. And in the pathogenesis, the fourth issue is the upper airway colonization in severely ill patients with gram-negative rods. Well, I have said I've spent two or three slides talking about gram-negative rods and the tendency of the resistant strains to more likely colonize and stick to the upper respiratory tract. But the fact is, where do they come from? Well, gastropulmonary route, is it a fact or fiction? Well, we are human beings, and human beings are full of bacteria. And, you know, which is why, and I don't want to be negative here, but when you hear reports of no cases of VAP in a year in large intensive care units, you know, it makes you wonder. And I personally, I have my doubts about that. But then, you know, I think the likelihood, how it happens, how does the gastropulmonary play a role? Well, you have microorganisms in the gut which might have proliferated under high pH alkaline conditions. It goes to the stomach, it goes up to the oropharynx, the trachea, and then the bronchus and the alveoli become infected, colonized or infected. So if you take what I have presented so far, we can get a basic risk profile. And as you can see, it's a complex interplay. The pathogenesis of VAPS is a complex interplay of mechanical ventilation and duration coupled with the host factors, which might be non-modifiable. You know, you might have a genetic component. And then with that, you might have a problem with the facility itself. So coupled, you might have untoward infection control practices and procedures, uncontrolled antimicrobial use, and compounded with contaminated equipment. And then in the patient, you might have aspiration from the oropharynx, gastric aspiration from the subglottal region of the respiratory tract, enteral feeding, and then the issue of biofilms. So all of these are presented in one file, in one slide, but it's a complex interplay, and the contribution of each of these factors to the pathogenesis is, you know, it's sometimes undefinable because we know that they are all playing their own significant role in the end result, which is a VAP. The next slide, the oropharynx. Taking all that I have said so far, there is a bulk of evidence that now suggests that the oral cavity is the primary source and that the oral cavity might be playing a larger role than the other risk factors, and the dental plaque might be playing a significant role. And this is a huge confounder because since 2006, there has been an increasing body of literature that suggests that Staph aureus is it's a common commensal in the oropharynx. Now, if Staph aureus is indeed a common commensal in the human oropharyngeal region, then that changes the epidemiology of Staph aureus transmission completely, because then that means that someone with Staph aureus in the oropharynx region could easily cough Staph aureus in droplets, and that's the theoretical possibility. So this is a huge confounder in the pathogenesis and the role that Staph aureus might be playing within the order of things. Now, let me go to the issue of VAP diagnosis. VAP, it's even in the year 2011, it's clouded by uncertainty, and this uncertainty is underscored by the fact that a reference standard has never been established. And here is what we do know. A VAP, to diagnose a VAP, you must have a chest X-ray. And chest radiology, what we know, it's very sensitive. That it will show up infiltrates, and it will show up, you know, segmental or fluffy infiltrates or atelectasis. However, it's typically nonspecific. And Wunderlich in 1992 established that there are no radiologic signs that correlates well with VAP. And we have known that, and there is, since 1992, there is a vast amount of literature that have confirmed that finding. So radiology signs do not correlate well with VAP. And the other slide, VAP diagnosis, there are a host of other clinical conditions that could be mistaken for a VAP. Lobar of subsegmental atelectasis, and atelectasis, as one knows, is basically collapse of alveoli, and that could be due to postural postural reasons, or if someone in the post-operative period is not breathing deeply, the alveoli at the bases of the lungs are more likely to not expand, and you get atelectasis. ARDS is often mistaken for a VAP. Alveolar hemorrhage, if you hemorrhage into the alveoli and you look at it on a chest X-ray, could easily be mistaken for a pneumonia. And then you have pulmonary infarction and or contusion, motor vehicle accidents. You look at chest X-rays from somebody with a motor vehicle accident, and you know, in the acute setting, the X-ray looks normal. The person has to be placed on a ventilator, and within 24 to 48 hours, signs show up, and it's due to the contusion, and it's diagnosed as VAP. So for VAP diagnosis, there's an old paradigm. There's clinical and radiologic signs, which are non-specific. So that tendency is, from a clinical and radiologic perspective, is to overdiagnose VAP. And then you might have signs of upper respiratory colonization. Signs, if you have upper respiratory colonization in someone with previous COPD, previous chronic lung disease, then that person might be producing sputum. And the sputum might have Staph aureus or gram-negative rods, and which brings us to the issue of colonization versus infection. Signs, what we do know, if you look at the microbiology and the clinical literature, is signs of upper respiratory colonization do not equate to infection of lung tissue. It's not true. The other old paradigm is there is this issue of presumed pneumonia. The old paradigm results in unnecessary prescribing for presumed pneumonia, which is you think about it. I spoke earlier about overprescribing. You treat with an antibiotic. Microorganisms like Enterobacter could easily become resistant in after 2 to 3 days of antimicrobial prescribing. And then you have this forceful selective pressure, and it's one big vicious cycle. You get resistant bugs, selecting antimicrobial prescribing leads to resistance in the gram-negative, and the gram-negative microorganisms are more likely to colonize and stick to the upper respiratory tract. So we are then, it's one big vicious cycle, and we get back to square one. Then we go on to the issue of clinical diagnosis. Johansson et al. In 1972 established criteria for new or progressive consolidation on a chest radiograph, and at least two of the following: fever, leukocytosis, or purulent secretions. And the big question is, how do these compare with post-mortem biopsies? Well, in 1999, Fabregas et al. Compared Johansson's criteria, the criteria I just mentioned, fever, leukocytosis, or leukopenia, and purulent secretions. He compared it with post-mortem lung biopsies. And what Fabregas showed was that Johansson's criteria, the sensitivity was only about 69%, and specificity no better than 75%. And yet, despite the, 69% sensitivity, 75% specificity is neither here nor there. And despite these low accuracy, these criteria were recommended by the American Thoracic Society consensus on VAP in 2005, which is relatively recent. Then we have other criteria by CDC. CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, developed other criteria for diagnosing VAP, and these criteria served as a tool to describe the epidemiology of hospital-acquired pneumonia. And these have been in place, in use since 1970, in the NIST hospitals that I talked about earlier. The criteria have never been validated with pathology, and the CDC criteria are for surveillance purposes only. And they are you get aggregated rates of infection for data generated from these surveillance criteria allows aggregated rates of infection for inter-hospital comparison. And the other criteria for VAPS include, and I'm sure listeners would have heard about the Clinical Pulmonary Infection Score, the CPIS, which Pugin described in 1991, and is based on six variables: fever, leukocytosis, tracheal aspirates, oxygenation, radiographic infiltrate, semi-quantitative cultures of tracheal aspirates with Gram stain. And what Pugin suggested is that a score greater than six is suggestive of a VAP. Now, this PIS score has been compared with pathological diagnoses, and it has been found to have a sensitivity of only 75%, and a specificity, depending on which paper you read, anyway, ranging anywhere between 42 to 85%. And there is a body of literature validating the CPIS with bronchoalveolar lavage for diagnosing VAP. However, there's a limitation with this. BAL, bronchoalveolar lavage culture, is not a true gold standard. So you really cannot, if BAL is not a true gold standard, you really cannot compare the CPIS score with something that's not a true gold standard. And there is another problem with the CPIS score, which is there is poor inter-observer agreement on calculating the CPIS. So one of you might see a patient and come up with a CPIS score, and I might go and look at the patient and our scoring, just by using our experience and using the criteria established by Pugin, we might easily end up with two different scores and come up with different diagnoses. I would like to point out that we need to differentiate between clinical and surveillance definitions, and that is a perennial problem that I encounter, because you come up with a surveillance definition and the clinician takes offense that thinks that one is auditing his clinical acumen. One can diagnose a VAP just based on a subjective assessment of a patient. A surveillance definition, as such as the one established by CDC, uses mainly objective criteria. So they are different. CDC surveillance definitions are for the surveillance purposes only, and I'd like to underscore that point. Now, here is a question that comes up all the time. What about the utility of bronchoalveolar lavage in the diagnosis of VAP? Well, Alvaro Reynato and colleagues conducted a meta-analysis of VAP in 2008. They looked at 572 articles fulfilling the initial search criteria. They ended up looking at 159 articles that were chosen for detailed review, and 64 of those articles fulfilled the inclusion criteria. And what they found, addition of the results of quantitative bacteriological cultures to clinical criteria, whether it's the Johansson or CPIS score, they do not increase the accuracy, that is, they do not increase the sensitivity or specificity in diagnosing VAP. And the data is unequivocal about that. So then that brings us to the question, what about quantitative cultures obtained by different methods? BAL, you might have BAL, protective BAL, protective specimen brushing, tracheobronchial aspirates. What about quantitative cultures obtained by the different methods? Well, quantitative cultures obtained by the different methods were equivalent in diagnosing VAP. And prior antimicrobial use considerably decreased the sensitivity of bronchoalveolar lavage in diagnosing VAP. So the meta-analysis showed that the tracheal aspirate has a sensitivity between 44 to 87% and a specificity between 31 and 92%, which is no different from a BAL, a bronchoalveolar lavage. And what we do know also is that the presence of bacteria on Gram stain, an immediate Gram stain, versus quantitative culture, which takes about 2 to 3 days to get back to those who need to know, was over 79% versus 86% agreement, which is considering that a quantitative culture on BAL, in one has to do a bronchoscopy, then it would make sense that a tracheal aspirate would be the best thing to do. So the conclusion was that BAL and tracheal aspirates were comparable in sensitivity and specificity. Gram stains to assess the inflammatory response and quantity of bacteria, that is doing looking at pus cells and bacteria from a smear, can serve as an immediate guide. The other conclusion is that quantitative cultures do not add to the clinical criteria and to any clinical information one might glean. And there are the conclusions. They looked at other markers such as C-reactive protein, procalcitonin, and soluble triggering receptors expressed on myeloid cells. And what these other markers are is the conclusion is they are promising biomarkers in diagnosing VAP, but at the moment, there is no evidence that they make any difference in the diagnosis. How about bronchioalveolar lavage versus endotracheal aspiration? Well, in 2006, there was a paper written in the New England Journal of Medicine from the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group, where they looked at immunocompetent adults receiving mechanical ventilation and in whom a VAP was suspected after 4 days in the ICU. So they did BAL with quantitative cultures, and they did endotracheal aspiration with non-quantitative cultures of the aspirate. However, Pseudomonas and MRSA infection or colonization were excluded from the study, which I believe is a huge bias, because in one of the earlier slides I showed you from the data generated from CDC on the pie chart, MRSA was the number one cause of VAPS, followed by Pseudomonas. So it doesn't make sense that the two key bugs were excluded in this study. However, what the results showed was that for BAL and endotracheal aspiration, the 28-day mortality in these patients was no different. If you look at the slide with bronchioalveolar lavage versus endotracheal aspiration, targeted therapy was not different. The days alive without antibiotic, 10.4 for BAL versus 10.6 for ETA, not significant. And the maximum organ dysfunction scores was similar. And the other thing that came out of this was that basically BAL plus quantitative cultures of the BAL fluid was equivalent to an endotracheal aspiration and non-quantitative cultures of the aspirate in terms of clinical outcomes and antimicrobial use. So, and again, that's a New England Journal of Medicine paper in 2006, volume 355, the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group. And I think that's useful information that BAL and endotracheal aspiration were so similar in terms of mortality, therapy, in targeted therapy, and days alive without antibiotics, notwithstanding the obvious bias in the study. And then there are other studies comparing BAL quantitative cultures with pathology, let me summarize it. The utility of bronchoscopy in the diagnosis of VAP. There is no evidence that routine bronchoscopy is useful if there is no clinical suspicion of a VAP. The data is unequivocal about that. And what we know is that blind BAL has a sensitivity of 73% and a specificity of 96%. And a 73% sensitivity for me in terms of the current era of the cost of the discussions of cost of healthcare in the United States and elsewhere, I think I'm just doing routine BAL, there are no evidence that supports that practice. Bronchioalveolar lavage versus endotracheal aspiration. And here is the other thing with bronchoscopy. Bronchoscopy can lead to mucosal damage. There's several studies out there, respiratory mucosal damage by flexible fiber optic bronchoscopy has been demonstrated in pigs. And what, if you think about it, after bronchoscopy, you get the tracheal bronchial clearance after flexible fiber optic bronchoscopy. The clearance ability is affected. And of course, it affects the mucociliary clearance, and that has a practical significance in patients unable to cough. You're more likely to get secretions. So what do we do here in 2011? What do we do? Well, let's take a look at the evidence. Rule number one, do not intubate unless necessary. Or if one is intubated, remove ASAP as soon as possible, because as I mentioned before, the highest risk is during the first 8 to 10 days of ventilation. And the other component for rule, the first rule, is if necessary, consider non-invasive mechanical ventilation, NIV, which has been documented. It has been documented that NIV is associated with lower rates and should be encouraged whenever appropriate. And there are multiple studies from France that support this practice. What about sedation interruption and weaning protocols? Well, there are several papers, Kress et al. In 2000, Marilek et al. In Chest in 2000. There is no evidence that sedation interruption and weaning protocols reduce VAP, but it's probably a good thing in terms of from a theoretical basis and just in terms of general good practice. But there are no evidence that they actually reduce the rates of VAP. How about modulation of gastric colonization? And because I mentioned earlier that increased pH can lead to, can encourage gastric colonization. Well, Halen et al. In 1999, they did a major study. And they looked at acidified parenteral feeds, and they looked at colonization. What we do know is that it does not translate. Modulation of gastric colonization does not translate to reduction in VAP. Which brings us again to the issue of supine body position. And what we do know, Draculovic et al. In the Lancet in 1999 established that semi-recumbent body position reduces rates of VAP. And in the next slide, semi-recumbent body position feasibility. A couple of years ago, Mark Bonten, who has done a lot in terms of looking at the epidemiology, Mark Bonten is from the Netherlands. He has looked at the epidemiology of VAPs and various preventive interventions. What Mark Bonten did, and I will just describe this briefly, he looked at a cohort of patients who were mechanically ventilated, and some were assigned to be maintained at 45 degrees, and another group, another cohort was assigned to be maintained at 10 degrees inclination. And what he found was that after several weeks, these beds all had transducers on them so that there was constant monitoring of the degree of inclination. What he found was that for those in whom a 45 degree inclination was designated, that there was huge fluctuations, you know, from going very flat from 0 to 45 degrees, and it was not consistent. But what he found for those who were designated at 10 degrees was that the fluctuations in the degree of recumbency was less marked compared to the 45 degrees. And what it suggests is, you know, in real terms, 45 degrees sometimes is difficult, especially in patients who might be semi-comatose, neurosurgery patients, patients with head trauma, etc. What Bonten's findings suggest is that perhaps the standard of care is somewhere in between 10 degrees to 30 degrees. So if one could maintain patients at least 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 30 degrees, then that's fine. But, you know, consistent, what we know is that a consistent maintenance at 45 degrees for a substantial number of patients is difficult to maintain. The other question, reduce oropharyngeal aspiration. How effective is this? Well, several studies have looked at subglottal aspiration and above the cuff and below the vocal cords, and at least five studies have shown marked reduction in rates of VAP. Then the issue of topical oral decontamination. Mark Bonten's group, Coleman and et al., published a paper in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine in 2006, and they used chlorhexidine gluconate 2% with and without colistin versus a placebo group, and they showed a 50 to 60% reduction in the incidence of VAP. This is just by virtue of this topical oral decontamination. And Chan et al. In the BMJ in 2007 did a meta-analysis, and they found a 40 to 50% reduction in the incidence of VAP just with oral antisepsis. There was no reduction in mortality, and there was no reduction in the duration of mechanical ventilation or stay in the intensive care, but there was a reduction in the incidence of VAP, which would obviously translate to a reduction in intra-hospital costs. The other big question is the role of selective digestive decontamination. There are over 50 major studies done looking at, there are several controlled, randomized, unblinded clinical trials. One of the problems with selective digestive decontamination, there have been single-center studies that have showed some effectiveness, but the generalizability has been, generalizability from single-center studies is a difficult thing to substantiate. And what we do know is that selective digestive decontamination is associated with a reduction in mortality and gram-negative rod colonization, but the data do not show a substantial reduction in rates of VAP. DeSmet et al. Looked at selective digestive contamination, and they published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2009. They looked at an ICU population in which the mortality rate was associated with the standard care. The mortality rate associated with standard care was about 27% at day 28, and the rate was reduced by an estimated 3.5 percentage points with selective digestive decontamination, and by 2.9 percentage points with selective oral decontamination. So selective digestive decontamination, the concept works if you look at the data, and basically selective digestive decontamination is probably equivalent to oral decontamination. But in terms of significant reductions in rate of VAP, there are no data to support it. How about silver-coated endotracheal tubes? Well, what we do know, Kolev et al. Looked in 2008, published a paper, and they looked at 54 centers in North America. And what we do know from the data are patients with silver-coated endotracheal tubes versus those receiving a similar tube but uncoated, there was a significant reduction in VAP incidence, and there was a delayed time to the onset of VAP. However, there was no statistically significant difference between group differences observed for durations of intubation, ICU stay, hospital stay, mortality, of frequency and severity of adverse events. Now, the next slide summarizes the requirements for the Institute of Health Improvement, otherwise known as the IHI ventilator bundle. And what they require is elevation, what they recommend is elevation of the head of the bed daily, which corresponds to CDC statement on elevation of the head of the bed, which is a category 2 recommendation, or aspirations prevention, which is a category 1A. They recommend sedation vacations and assessment of readiness to extubate, which corresponds to CDC's removal of devices, which is a category 1B. Peptic ulcer disease prophylaxis, which is a CDC unresolved issue, along with deep vein thrombosis prophylaxis. And that these comprise the IHI ventilator bundle. However, even though theoretically it's a good thing, there is no evidence yet that VAP bundles reduce the incidence of VAP. The next slide just summarizes the evidence that I have presented so far. Hospital-associated infections. You have lower respiratory infections, and you have modifiable risk factors. There's strong evidence, in summary, that semi-recumbent positions make a difference, non-invasive ventilation, continuous lateral rotation, and subglottic suctioning. There is some evidence for avoidance of oversedation, avoidance of paralytics, closed suctioning, orotracheal intubation, adequate cuff pressures, and avoidance of H2 antagonists. So the bottom line in 2011, per evidence-based data, is this is what should be done. Based on the evidence I've presented so far, is non-invasive ventilation, if possible, orotracheal intubation, oral versus nasal feeding tubes, reduction of the days of intubation, if possible, a restructuring of antimicrobial policies in the institution. That's the sine qua non. That's part and parcel of any intervention. A high level of hygiene, which again goes back to the importance of practices and procedures and hand hygiene and compliance. The semi-recumbent position at least 10 degrees if possible, clohexidine oral care, and subglottic aspiration. And the sine qua non is basically surveillance and education. You need to monitor VAP rates and use the established benchmarks and definitions of pneumonia to carry out surveillance, provide feedback to the staff about facility VAP rates, reminders about the need for adherence to infection control practices and procedures, and a need to change the culture because, you know, it doesn't work. There has to be accountability in healthcare facilities in the United States and abroad if these recommendations are to be instituted. Mechanical ventilation, non-invasive mechanical ventilation, we know is associated with lower rates and should be encouraged whenever appropriate. The Canadian Critical Care Group, you know, they recommend perhaps a stepwise approach. You know, start with the evidence-based basics, and then you go on. So you emphasize good hand hygiene. There are no randomized controlled trials for hand hygiene, but it's still considered effective. And then, you know, you go on. You start with a semi-recumbent positioning, which might be underutilized, continuous subglottic secretion removal, oral versus nasal feeding tubes, targeted oral hygiene, sedation, vacation, and weaning assessment, which might be underutilized, and stress ulcer prophylaxis using sucralfate, selective digestive tract decontamination. It has been used in Europe, but as I mentioned, it doesn't translate to North America. And one of the reasons it might have to do with antimicrobial resistance issues in ICUs. And then we go on to the strategy summary, number 8, interruption of person-to-person transmission of bacteria, standard precautions, care of patients with tracheostomy, suctioning, and then modifying host risks. Vaccines, pneumococcal vaccine, which is a category 1A, prevention of aspiration precautions and other prophylactic procedures for pneumonia. Hospital-acquired diagnosis. Do not culture intubated patients unless pneumonia is suspected. If you culture secretion, something will grow. Doesn't mean the person has a pneumonia. And do a Gram stain with each culture. Look for white counts. You look for inflammation. So the final conclusions are quantitative BAL cultures do not reduce antibiotic use. They do not enhance sensitivity of diagnosis. And bronchoscopy may indeed reduce bacterial clearance, especially in those lacking a cough. Tracheobronchial suction demonstrates similar sensitivity and specificity, and is less invasive. The final conclusions continued, Gram stain in combination with standard tracheobronchial culture and clinical criteria should be the standard of care based on the published data. Broad spectrum coverage followed by narrowed coverage and short course therapy promised to reduce the selection of resistance and avoid anti-anaerobic agents if at all possible. Now, I'm going to end by just telling you about a study I did in 2008 and I'm writing up at the moment. I looked at 143 lung tissue specimens from, these are post-mortem lung tissue specimens in patients who had been diagnosed in the chart, in the medical chart, with hospital-acquired pneumonias. And of these 142 lung tissue specimens, they were all looked at by a single experienced histopathologist with over 40 years experience, one person which mitigated any bias. And of those 143 lung tissue specimens, 14, which is 9.8%, showed histological evidence of an acute pneumonia. And the median age of patients with and without histological evidence of acute pneumonia was 83.6 years and 73.5 years, respectively, which was statistically significant. So basically, patients with histological evidence were older, were significantly older. And here is the interesting finding, was the most common histological diagnoses were acute and chronic heart failure, focal chronic atelectasis, emphysema, pulmonary hypertension, and chronic atelectasis. So what that is that this underscores the point that VAPs are overdiagnosed, and which brings us back to the importance of looking at all data carefully, examining patients properly, and not doing tests unnecessarily, tests that are likely to make you more likely to diagnose a VAP. And the last graph is actually from the University of Florida, which is really interesting. So if you look at the initial, we have reduced VAP incidence densities by instituting stepwise a variety of the interventions I have outlined so far. Semi-recumbent positions, just a list of the subglottic suctioning, etc. And then, as you can see from the graph, it got down to a plateau with just a little bit of fluctuation. But then, at the beginning of the last segment of the graph, we instituted a single intervention of oral hygiene using chlorhexidine gluconate mouthwashes. And you can see that the graph, there was a further fall following the plateau following the plateauing of the incidence densities, there was a further fall temporarily following the institution of the chlorhexidine gluconate mouthwash. So, and I think this just confirms the finding by Mark Bonten's group and various groups from Germany that oral decontamination is an important factor, and it does reduce the incidence of VAPS. I'm going to end there. My last slide is: learning is like rowing upstream. You know, not to advance is to fall back. But the thing about it is, we must apply the evidence-based data. Knowing is not enough, according to Goethe. We must apply it, and we must be willing to actually implement those findings. Thank you very much, and hopefully I will get some comments and questions via email. Again, thank you for listening. Bye.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Archibald. As you have seen from the slide just before, that wonderful picture of Mount Kilimanjaro, Dr. Archibald has left his email address that you can forward some questions directly to him. Alternatively, you can use the teleclass email address, which is info@webertraining.com. This was an excellent lecture. I learned a great deal about this very notable infection in the hospital setting. We would like to say thank you so much for attending today's teleclass. And thank you, Dr. Archibald, for this excellent presentation. We'd like to say thank you again to Paul Weber and Dr. Saeed Sattar for establishing the teleclass series. And with that, we will say good day to our audience. Take care. Have a good one.
Thank you.